Hello and welcome to Quadriga, coming to you from the heart of Berlin. And the focus this week is on US President Donald Trump, who has now been in the White House for 2 years. And we're marking that anniversary by taking a closer look at Trump's America. The economy continues to hold up, but the country is deeply divided, as is clear from the longest government shutdown in US history. In foreign policy, meanwhile, the US has pulled out of a number of key international agreements, and a recent surprise announcement that Washington plans to withdraw American forces from Syria left many commentators asking who will step into the breach. So our question on Quadriga this week is 2 years of Trump, what next from the wrecking ball? And to discuss that question, I'm joined by three astute observers here in the studio, beginning with Grace Dobusch, who's an American, a freelance journalist and an editor at the business daily Handelsblatt. She says Trump has brought out Americans' true colours. Interesting stuff. Also with us is Matthew Karnichnik, chief Europe correspondent with Politico. He says Trump may be the president everybody loves to hate. What's harder to acknowledge, though, is that his impact hasn't been all bad. And a warm welcome too to Valerie Herner. Valerie has a transatlantic background and works for Spiegel Online. And she argues that Donald Trump has divided not only the nation, but also the world. America's allies no longer regard the US as a reliable partner. Three interesting comments to begin the show. I'd like to begin with yours, Grace. You say that President Trump has brought out Americans' true colours. What are the true colours of the American people? I'm fascinated to find out.
I think we've had in the last few decades this increasing difficulty in discussing items of importance with each other, with discussing issues in a way that is thoughtful. And Trump has just exacerbated that to a degree that we've not seen in recent history. I think that there are a lot of discussions happening right now regarding basic human rights that would have been inexplicable even 5 years ago.
Give us an example of one of the human rights you're talking about that is in contention.
Oh, my goodness, how many can I list? I mean, aside from the right of people to seek asylum in the United States being called into question, the backpedaling on rights for LGBT people, the discussions and the... not civil wars, but the very impassioned discussions happening about police brutality and treatment of black and brown people in America, all of these things... they've been boiling under the surface for a long time, and Trump has now gotten them to a point where it's all coming to the surface.
Mm. And freedom of press.
Absolutely, yes.
It's under attack.
Well, nevertheless, Valerie, you mentioned that, and we've heard what Grace has to say. President Trump gives himself an A-plus rating for his first 2 years in office. What has he got right?
Wow, that's a hard question. In my opinion, he hasn't gotten much right. I mean, I feel like he has divided the nation so far that really between the Americas, Trump America, and the America, liberal America, is just such a vast ground that I don't really see how people are going to cover that, mm-hmm. how people are going to get back to a point where they can talk to each other, where respectfully they can acknowledge that they have different points of view and that's okay. So I feel like he hasn't done much right in sense of that. I'm sorry, I can't give a more satisfying answer.
I knew it was going to be tricky for you, but Matthew is willing to break a lance for President Trump. Yeah? You say that President Trump's impact hasn't been all bad.
Well, I think it depends what you measure him by. Certainly in the foreign policy sphere, if you look at what he set out to do and what he's doing on the economy, I think a lot of people look at him and they were against the policies that he campaigned on to begin with. And so by that yardstick, if you will, of course, you'll be against him and you'll say that, you know, these aren't good things. But if you look at what he promised during the campaign, things like pulling out of the Paris climate deal, things like pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, things like pulling out of the Middle East, which he hasn't really done yet, but he's threatened to and is in the process of. These are all things that, you know, that he's doing. And this is why, you know, his supporters elected him to be president. So I think it's a, you know, it's important to differentiate between one's own views of his policies and what he promised to do. And he certainly is fulfilling that. I would challenge Grace a little bit on this idea that he's, you know, divided the country more than it was, because the country was pretty divided even before he got elected. And certainly, you know, Obama was somebody who also divided the country, or at the by the end of his presidency, it was much more divided than before. And a lot of these issues that are coming up, the racial tensions, stuff like this, you know, these have been sort of constants in American history, you know, really since the Civil War. You know, as you might remember, things like the Rodney King uprising, or the uprising in and riots in Los Angeles after the Rodney King beating in the early 90s, and things like this. These are things that have always happened, but now it does seem that there is an acceleration, and maybe also because of social media and a lot of these technological changes that we've seen, the reaction is much quicker and much more forceful, as we saw over the weekend, for example, with this protest by a Native American in Washington, D.C., and this standoff between him and these white college students. And that was high school students, sorry. And this was just an explosive reaction, and people responding to something that they didn't really, you know, the facts hadn't really come out about what happened leading up to that. And everything here, and they were wearing Trump Make America Great Again hats. And so this is all sort of, you know, put on Trump again, which I think might be a little bit unfair.
Yeah, but I mean, legislation-wise, we didn't see anything like the Muslim travel ban. I mean, that's something that is poured into legislation. So I think it is a difference if the president is sort of enhancing these discussions, amplifying all of these,
enabling
these tensions. Right.
Exactly. I see it a lot.
It's something
enabling.
Else he promised to do. Sorry, it is something that he said he would do during the campaign. But
he said he would enhance or amplify or enable racial tension.
I mean, ban Muslims from coming into the country,
but, or his reaction to Charlottesville. I mean, that was one of the most disturbing things I think I've ever witnessed in politics. Like him, well, you know what I mean.
The idea that there were bad guys on both sides.
Right, exactly.
Of a pretty clear attack, yeah.
Right.
I'd like to hear just a little bit, Matthew, about what you have got to say about President Trump's method, because it often seems sort of to be pretty destructive. Has he made it his mission to destroy pretty much everything that remains of President Obama and the liberal sort of heritage?
It certainly seems so, and he's said as much. He wants to reverse everything that Obama did, and he's said about it, really.
So there's method in the madness. It's a Nietzschean kind of project. Destroy a lot of stuff to rebuild.
He ran as a change agent, and this is what his voters wanted of him. And, you know, he is certainly fulfilling that, including, I think, by shutting down the government and sort of starving the federal government of funds. This is a long-time, you know, conservative priority to basically, you know, make the federal government more or less unable to spend money because it is too bloated already to saddle it with so much debt, to saddle the country with so much debt, which he's doing through the tax cuts, which is something he also campaigned on and followed through with. So, you know, I think that there is a bit of method behind the madness, and also, you know, on the international front.
Okay, you mentioned the shutdown. It has brought hardship to some 800,000 federal workers in the U.S., President Trump is insisting, though, that it will go on until he gets his wall along the border with Mexico.
And you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
At the White House on December 11th, there was a very public spat in the Oval Office.
20 times. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And I am proud, and I'll tell you what.
We disagree.
Trump followed through on his threat, and the Democrats continued to refuse funding for Trump's wall.
Again, we saw a temper tantrum because he couldn't get his way, and he just walked out of the meeting.
I very calmly walked out of the room. I didn't smash the table. I should have, but I didn't smash the table. And that's the story. So all of that narrative is a lie.
But the fact is that what the president is proposing is not the best way to protect our borders.
Over the years, thousands of Americans have been brutally killed by those who illegally entered our country, and thousands more lives will be lost if we don't act right now.
President Trump must stop holding the American people hostage, must stop manufacturing a crisis, and must reopen the government.
Can there be any winners in this battle?
Okay, Grace, let's take that question straight. Can there be any winners in this remarkably, breathtakingly ugly battle?
I'm not sure who's going to be the winner, but there are going to be, obviously, a lot of casualties. Namely, the hundreds of thousands of federal workers who are going without pay as long as this shutdown continues. Not to mention all of the contractors who work for the government who are also out of work at the moment.
It's interesting that you say that because obviously many of those 800,000 people will be on very tight budgets indeed, and they'll be very hard pushed at this point in time. Trump was, of course, in large measure voted into office initially by people he calls, and I'm quoting now, the forgotten men and women of America. He promised that they would be forgotten no longer. Has he delivered on that promise in any way?
He has delivered on that in that he continues to speak to them and to push forward the interests, no matter how misguided, of people who for the past few decades have felt ignored by Washington, I think.
Valerie, has President Trump delivered on his promises to his own people, to his own constituency, as it were?
Well, I think that economically speaking, with the tariffs, a lot of these people in the Rust Belt are also, they actually are not making more money. The steel industry is going down. The farmers are making less money because of the tariffs. So I'm not really sure if he's economically delivered, but I agree that he definitely continues to speak to them and continues to speak to a sort of sense of accomplishment that they want to be heard or that they have accomplished whatever they think is important for their lives. I do feel that they do that, yes.
Matthew, the economy softening up a bit, slowing down a little bit, the shutdown, is that a challenge to President Trump's pride in his own sense that he's the right person to steward, to manage the economy, to reinvigorate the economy? Because that's where the next election will probably be decided.
Absolutely, and that's why his strategy here, particularly on trade and the trade standoff with China, it has yet to play out. And if it plays out in his favor, meaning if China actually makes concessions, if the Europeans make concessions, then you know he will have won. Right now, it's not looking very good because the American economy is slowing down a bit. It's still growing much at a much stronger pace than most of the European economy is, but I think that it would probably be a few months before we know where that goes. But there are signs that he's making progress on that front. That the confrontational approach, particularly with the Europeans, is working. They've now come back to the table on the trade front and said, okay, well, we're willing to talk about this and this and this. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see in the coming weeks some kind of agreement on cars between the Europeans and the U.S. So, at the moment, it's certainly the case that the Chinese are suffering more than the Americans on from the tariffs. Mm-hmm.
I would like to point out, though, that this week a White House economist said that the shutdown likely will drive the growth of GDP this quarter to 0%, which is maybe even an optimistic number. Depending on how much longer the shutdown continues.
It's already cost more. It's the cost of the economy more than the wall would cost. I heard $5 billion.
That some Republican senators are openly speaking out against the shutdown and also that they think it's an existential question. And if they do, I mean, I think they have to rally behind him. But
why existential? In deciding what?
In deciding the fate of the Republican Party. If they go against the president, then and they have all rallied behind him and tied their fates to him, for better or for worse. And so I feel like they have to sort of rally behind him, even though I'm not sure how Mitch McConnell really feels about the shutdown. And I'm not sure how a lot of senators are viewing this. So I think, and I mean, he went and visited them, didn't he, like just recently? And that's a clear sign that he's afraid that they're not going to vote in his favor. So at some point,
picking up on that, how likely, or it is broadly claimed, and increasingly claimed, that Donald Trump and his policies have triggered a progressive renaissance in the United States. Is that a renaissance of progressive forces? Mm-hmm. Is that true, do you think? Is it plausible or is it wishful thinking on the part of the sort of the liberal left?
I think it's mobilized a lot of young people who maybe were indifferent or just mildly interested in politics before. I think that this resistance movement that sprung up in the months following Trump's election, it has legs. It was mobilized in the House election last November. Mm-hmm. Not as strongly as people would have liked, but I think we saw effects of that. And the question now is whether Democrats will be able to continue that, holding that interest and continue channeling that anger into elections in 2020.
Especially if they have something like Sanders versus Clinton. I think that was a big part of why people stopped rallying behind one candidate. Like friends of mine, I know, then decided to not vote for Clinton, which I think was, well, in my opinion, that was, well, you know, it's their thing. But I feel like if they find a candidate that everyone can rally behind, then they really have a good chance of winning this next election. But we'll see.
Okay. Let's address Trump's foreign policy, which has undoubtedly been a roller coaster. His approach to international relations described as variously mercurial or impulsive. Lately, there's been confusion, too, over his administration's policy on Syria. Talk of withdrawing US troops has opened up a potential power vacuum. And the question is, who will fill it?
The Kurdish city of Manbij in northern Syria. 19 people were killed in a suicide bombing here last week, including 4 Americans. So-called Islamic State has claimed responsibility. That attack came less than 4 weeks after Trump had announced the pullout of the 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria, saying that IS had been defeated and the U.S. could no longer be the world's policeman.
So we're not the suckers of the world.
His decision has left the field open for other parties in the conflict. The Russian president and ally of Syria's Bashar al-Assad was clearly pleased.
If the U.S. decided to withdraw its forces, that's correct.
And Turkey's president also sees his chances of launching an offensive against the Kurds in northern Syria improving.
Those who are part of the terror corridor in Syria will receive the necessary lesson. There is no difference between the PKK, YPG, PYD, and Daesh.
The United States has been a guarantor of security, and not just for the Kurds. What risks are posed by an American pullout?
What risks indeed, Matthew, after this suggestion that the U.S. could possibly pull out of Syria? They've withdrawn from the nuclear pact with Iran, the global climate accord, a trade pact with Asia. Germany has been bemoaning that, has been talking about a giant vacuum left by the collapse of American leadership. How concerned are you by the giant vacuum?
Well, I don't really see the giant vacuum, to be honest. I mean, the United States is still here. They still have, I think, about 40,000 troops stationed in Germany. And for the past 70 years, the United States has guaranteed the security of this country and continues to do so. And it's been a pretty good deal for Germany, actually, because they haven't had to spend that much on their military. They have this security guarantee. And not only that, they've been able to tap the American market relatively unfettered. It's a, you know, it would be difficult to look back into world history to find a country that has a deal like that.
Why are the Europeans then so worried?
Well, because they're professional warriors. That's why they always need something to worry about. There's always this kind of woe is me. There's been a long history of this. If you look back into the 1980s, when Reagan wanted to station the Persian missiles here during the Cold War and all of the upheaval that created, the Europeans are always worried about what the United States is going to do. But when it comes down to it, the United States has always been here when it mattered in World War I and World War II, in the Second World War. And these discussions about the Middle East, the United States doesn't have a very large presence in Syria. I mean, we wouldn't be pulling out very many people to begin with. And I think there is a debate that, you know, has to happen in the United States as well. How long are we going to be in the Middle East? Because there's always an ISIS, there's always an Al-Qaeda, and there's always going to be this argument, you know, well, if you pull out now, then, you know, they're going to come back. And, well, then you need to decide, well, you're going to be there forever. Look how long the U.S. has been in Afghanistan now. You know, it's going on 20 years, which is much longer than we were in Vietnam.
What do you say about this realpolitik, ladies?
Well, I feel like you have a point. I think that the Germans always it was quite easy for them to be like, oh, we're pacifists, because obviously you have the U.S. and the U.S. Army that, you know, should push come to shove, they were going to step in. And I think there was always that sort of security that the Germans had. And obviously, regarding the history, that's one of the reasons is why no one wanted Germany to have a strong military. And I think it's just a big question over how the European Union is going to set up their security forces with France and Germany. And I think that's going to be a big debate in the next years. I don't really feel, but
I think you're right. It'll be a big debate, and then ultimately nothing will happen because they don't want to spend the money on it.
But America started pulling back as the world policeman under Obama as well. So I think this is not something we're only just seeing now.
Grace, there's a sense in Germany that the US has it in for Germany, has it in for the Chancellor, and has it in for the EU. Do you buy into that?
The US as a whole or Trump specifically?
I'll give you a quote from Mike Pompeo, for example. He says that, talking about the EU, you know, every reason to wonder whether the EU will actually survive. He just recently came out and said the EU is one of those international bodies that must be reformed or eliminated. No wonder, then, that people here in Europe, here in Germany, are moaning about their woes about the end of transatlanticism and so on and so forth.
I mean, to mangle a Mark Twain quote, I think the death of the EU is greatly exaggerated. Uh-huh. I think, really, in this time of upheaval in the United States and the idea that there's maybe a power vacuum where the U.S. is pulling out, this is a time for the EU, specifically Germany, to step up and shine, to become that beacon of liberal democracy, to become a good example for the world.
Yeah, but how can Germany really become the beacon of liberal democracy? I feel like America is the image of that. That's where...
But we've seen now with the increased divisions and the social strife happening, I think we now see more clearly than ever the faults that come from the American system, the lack of the lack of any type of social safety net, for example.
Matthew, there are those who suggest that Vladimir Putin and the Americans and Donald Trump have the same objective, that is weakening the EU and its member nations.
I don't see why that would really be in the interest of the United States, to be honest, because, you know, the U.S. is very engaged here, also economically. The EU is a hugely important market for American business, also strategically. I think that, you know, if you look at what the U.S. is doing in Europe at the moment, the strategic objectives, one thing is to get the Russians not to build this pipeline with the Germans, for example, Nord Stream 2, so that the U.S. can sell more of its own gas to Europe. And this is an example, I think, if you look at, you know, all of these accusations out there, the U.S. is against multilateralism and the Germans are now a beacon of liberal democracy and multilateralism. Well, where is multilateralism in the Nord Stream 2 discussion, for example, where the rest of Europe is against it, the United States is against it, and you have Germany standing up
stubbornly
and, you know, insisting that this go through. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is why, where we started out with Trump's personality really offends a lot of people. You know, it's more about the style often than the substance of what he's saying and doing.
Grace, to talk about style and substance in just to go off at a little bit of a tangent, but a question that is important to me. I've made a little list. Trump, Brexit, Bolsonaro, the Yellow Vests, Orban and Salvini. What do they have in common?
Is this a riddle? It sounds like I don't think anyone's going to like the punchline to the joke.
It's not a riddle. I'm wondering whether Donald Trump is the beacon of populist far-right political tendencies around the world, rather than America being the beacon of liberal democracy as it traditionally was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing now in Brazil seems to be an echo of the type of politics that Trump has been purveying in the United States for the past 2 years. Like Trump, Bolsonaro is a big Twitter user, enjoys making inflammatory statements and speaking up for traditional values at the cost of any type of disadvantaged people. That may well have happened no matter who is in the American White House, but it certainly seems to then be a global trend.
Valerie, you're nodding.
Oh, I agree. I think what they have in common is that they're populist movements, but the Yellow Vests are left-wing radicals and right-wing
We don't quite know what's going on, really, do we really?
Yeah. We don't really know what's going on there. But I do feel like that populism is on the rise, and it has been for a couple of years. I mean, the Front National, we see it all across Europe. I'm not really sure what came first, the hen or the egg, like Trump, but being the beacon of that. But I do feel like Bolsonaro, I know that has been called mini Trump or has been called, you know, Brazil's Trump. So mm-hmm. I think that style is more acceptable to us as media as well. Definitely has to do with Trump being such a big influence on everyone.
Okay, give me in one sentence each of you what should we expect from Donald Trump in the next year, the next 2 years? He's got 2 years. In a nutshell,
I would say more unpredictability.
I agree.
I'm still holding out hope for those tax returns.
Okay, we've got to get out now. Thanks for joining us here on Quadriga this week. Do come back next time round if you've enjoyed the show. Bye-bye and tschüss.